Welcome to this week's episode of The Read Out Loud, a weekly biotech podcast from STAT. I'm Allison DeAngelis.
I'm Adam Feuerstein.
And I'm Damian Garde.
It's Thursday, March 14th, and here's what we're going to talk about this week.
What happens when an FDA-approved drug turns out not to work? Bioethicist Holly Fernandez-Lynch joins us to discuss the case of Amylyx Pharmaceuticals' treatment for ALS and what its failure means for drug development.
We'll also discuss the latest news in the life sciences, including a tepid reception for gene therapies, the future of CAR-T cancer treatment, and the first approved treatment for a prevalent liver disease.
All that's coming after a word from our sponsor.
Pharma and biotech companies claim to put the patient at the center of what they do. But what does focusing on patients really mean? How should it shape their research and development efforts? And how should patient voices shape regulation, commerce, and the practice of medicine? Join us March 21st in New York City for the STAT Breakthrough Summit East as we explore these questions. We'll gather top biotech and health tech experts, C-suite leaders, and of course, patients, to deliver real answers about how to ensure scientific breakthroughs make it where they're needed the most. Virtual and in-person tickets are selling fast. Secure your spot to the STAT Breakthrough Summit East at statnews.com/events.
So today is March 14th, Pi Day, and we're having a pie contest in the STAT Boston HQ office. Allison, what did you make for the contest?
Well, I can reveal now because we are separate from the rest of the contestants and the judges in the pie contest. So I'm not,
You're not lobbying for victory?
I'm not lobbying for victory, though I think my victory should be clear. I made a cranberry lime pie with a ginger snap crust.
Ooh, ginger snap crust.
Yes.
That's nice. Now, I went classic. I went key lime pie, graham cracker crust. So, you know, classic. Now, Damian, you're not here, so we'll have to send you pieces of pie in the mail.
Please do. I haven't baked anything since probably I was around the seventh grade. What is the prize for victory in the pie war?
That's a good question.
Called?
I don't even know what the prize is. Maybe it's just bragging rights for a year that you're the STAT's best pie maker.
Yeah, I think it's bragging rights. And I don't know.
See, I went citrus, and so did Allison, knowing, and I don't think Rick, our boss, is the ultimate judge, but I know he likes citrus pie. So I went, that's why I went citrus.
This is really a full lobbying effort for Rick's affection. I don't care about the trophy or what have you.
And anyway, next week we'll reveal the winner. We'll talk. Maybe it'll be Allison. Maybe it'll be me. Maybe it'll be Teresa.
Our producer
is sitting here. What did you make, Teresa? Tell us.
I made a potato and cheese galette.
Potato and went savory.
She went, yeah, we have a savory
smart.
And a sweet category.
Very smart. That's good strategic thinking, you know, against the grain. All right, we should get back to biotech now.
Wow. Yeah, no, for all the people smashing their 30 seconds forward button on your favorite podcast app, you could stop doing that now or keep going. I can't tell you what to do. Anyway, maybe let's start this week. Our colleague Jason Mass had what I thought was a really fascinating story looking at hemophilia, A and B, and the gene therapies that now, after four decades or more, really, depending on how you look at it, of research and development, those gene therapies are now available. These are one-time treatments that in clinical trials have made it to where patients with hemophilia, a disease that stops your blood from properly clotting, have been free of bleeding events for years after getting just one dose of it. But what was fascinating about Jason's story was that despite the long wait for these medicines and despite their clinical promise, people don't seem to really want them. Only a handful of patients have received either the hemophilia A or hemophilia B gene therapies since they become available in 2022 and 2023, respectively. And it's kind of a fascinating case study of there can sometimes be a chasm between scientific success and practical medicinal demand that I can't really think of other examples of this, but it feels like it's instructive in some kind of way.
Yeah, I thought what was interesting about the story, and it was a great story, you know, is that when we've talked about gene therapies in the past, you know, obviously we've talked about their high costs, right? These are multi-million dollar therapies, one-time therapies. And so there's always been this talk about access and insurance and reimbursement and how you pay for these treatments. But in the case of these hemophilia treatments, it's not a case of insurers restricting access or saying that they're not going to or unwilling to pay for these hemophilia gene therapies. It's really more about the fact that these patients are very well controlled on current medications that they take to, you know, to basically return them to sort of normal lives. And, you know, sort of an unwillingness to kind of rock the boat or to change up and to take something that has a little bit more uncertainty, right? And particularly when it comes to, as the story notes, Damien, you saw, it's the hemophilia A product from BioMarin, where there's some question about durability, you know, how effective is this over the long term? And so patients and their physicians are kind of looking at all of this and saying, you know, well, let's just wait a while. I thought that was a really interesting aspect of the story.
Yeah. And to add on to that, patients recognizing and physicians recognizing that with this first generation of gene therapies, there is, you know, questions about kind of the long-term efficacy for some of these products. Also, there's questions of what's coming down the pipeline, because some of these therapies, if you get the first generation drug, that's it. You can't get another one. And, you know, patients and doctors are very cognizant of that fact. And I mean, honestly, like if you're going to embark in a new frontier, do you really want to do like the self-driving car Model 1, or do you want to wait for Model 2, Model 3?
There was a quote in the story, actually, Jason talked to a patient who basically said just that, right? He said, like, you know, generally I just don't take version 1.0 of anything, whether it's an iPhone or a toaster or something, you know, computer. Like, you kind of wait for the second version so that they work all the bugs out, you know, and that's a really interesting point of view. You know, again, and that is from somebody with hemophilia, and I think that was one of the nice things about the story too was that, you know, we were hearing from people with hemophilia, living with hemophilia, who are sort of having to make these decisions.
Yeah, it's really a fascinating conversation because, as you mentioned, Adam, you know, when gene therapies were starting to approach the market, all of our conversation was on price and payer reimbursement. That has turned out to not be an issue in these cases largely, and it's really come down to patient preference.
So moving on, Damien, we're obviously recording this on Thursdays like we always do. Tomorrow, the FDA is holding an advisory panel meeting to discuss a couple of different CAR T therapies for multiple myeloma. What is it about those therapies that the FDA felt they needed to sort of have outside input and talk about some of the risks and benefits of these treatments?
It's interesting. This kind of relates to the conversation around gene therapy, albeit a little bit different. But CAR T, as people probably know, is a very powerful treatment for cancer, which carries with it a pretty heavy side effect burden by virtue of this is a matter of taking a patient's own immune cells, genetically engineering them external to the patient, then infusing them back in. And even that process is kind of, a vulgar dismissal of how complicated it is and how taxing it can be for patients. But we know that the benefits of CAR T therapy are so strong that it more than justifies the unpleasant side effects and the risk, frankly, of death from receiving these medicines for patients with severe cancers that have withstood other available therapies. But the business case of CAR T relies on expanding its use from those patients who have tried 3, 4, even 5 lines of therapy to patients who perhaps have tried only 1 or 2. And that is a long-winded windup to what is happening on Friday, which is that the FDA is convening a panel of outside experts to look at 2 CAR T therapies, one from Johnson & Johnson and the Chinese firm Legend Biotech, the other from Bristol Myers Squibb, which is partnered with 270, what is Bluebird called now?
270 Bio. Yeah. Exactly.
270 Bio. I don't know where 272 came from. Anyway, so these are 2, as you mentioned, Adam, multiple myeloma CAR T therapies that are already approved for those more advanced patients, but whose sponsors are seeking approval in patients with less severe disease or who have tried fewer lines of therapy. And the reason that the FDA is digging into this is that in their supporting clinical trials, in the early months of studies, the rate of death for treated patients outpace that of patients getting the standard of care because of these side effects. And these are small numbers, and those trends reversed over the fullness of the trial. The trials were successful. The CAR T outperformed the standard of care. But that risk of, you know, patients potentially having a worse time with treatment than without treatment is obviously cause for alarm within the FDA. And in the briefing documents, FDA reviewers, I don't want to say were harsh, but made clear that this is something they perceive to be meriting attention. And it's possible that the FDA will decide that the benefits don't outweigh the risks for the earlier stage patients with this disease. And that could have kind of a ripple effect through CAR T, where, as I mentioned, the push for the last few years, really, from all CAR T manufacturers is to try to find a way to develop these medicines such that they might become more commonplace in the treatment of cancers rather than just relegated to those, again, like fifth line, sixth line patients.
Yeah, and I expect this discussion on Friday to talk a lot about what is known as bridging therapy. And that's kind of what, you know, when you think about these therapies, you know, these are, again, as we mentioned, these are patient specific, so they have to be made for each patient. And making these CAR T treatments for patients takes time. It takes a while for these treatments to actually be manufactured. And in that interim period, patients get other forms of chemotherapy as what they call bridging therapy, basically to kind of keep them stable while they wait for their CAR T. And so I think it's thought that that was one of the things that came up in these in the briefing documents is that, you know, what impact do these bridging therapies have on the patients and on the survival, particularly like you mentioned, Damien, this sort of early period where it seems like sometimes you know, there might be a survival imbalance in these studies. So, you know, it sort of brings up kind of just one of the underlying weaknesses in the personalized CAR T therapy, that it still takes a long time to make these things. And so you would think that's kind of an opening for the off-the-shelf CAR T therapies that are in development now, although they really haven't been able to show as good efficacy, durability yet as the personalized CAR Ts.
Yeah, and beyond the survival rates for these patients, these two drugs that we're talking about also have very different risk of relapse statistics attached to them. If I'm getting my numbers correctly, you know, Carvykti, the phase 3 data showed that there was a 74% reduced risk of relapse for patients. Abecma was 51%. And I think it's worth noting, like, the FDA, the AdCom is going to be voting separately on each one of these products. They have questions for each specific product. And I'm really wondering if we're going to see a split decision tomorrow from the AdCom.
So MASH, formerly called NASH, even just I hear that in the voice of Freddie Mercury in the, like, Flash Gordon theme song, which I won't sing, as I don't sing on this
MASH
podcast famously.
Does anyone remember the old Flash Gordon movie? I do. With the Queen soundtrack. That was really, that was a really good movie.
Staple VHS.
One of these days we're
going
to get Damien to sing on this podcast. It's going to happen.
I'll let you know. Anyway, so MASH, a very prevalent fatty liver disease, and, you know, the context in which it became a big deal in the drug industry world is that there were no approved medicines for it, and yet it affects millions of people. And you can imagine, running the numbers there, that is a huge business opportunity. Years and years of clinical setbacks and regulatory issues cut to literally today, Thursday, March 14th. It is the FDA decision date for what would be the first approved medicine for MASH. Adam, I know you spent time with the developer and manufacturer of that drug, Madrigal Pharmaceuticals. What do we need to know as we face this brave new world?
Yeah, as we record, we're still waiting for the FDA's announcement, the decision. I think most people, it's widely expected that this drug called resmetirom, we don't know the brand name yet, will be approved. It will be the first treatment for, as you said, MASH. That's a landmark. I mean, that's a milestone. I talked to a couple of physicians who specialize in treating patients with liver disease, including MASH. And, you know, I think there's a lot of excitement for people, you know, for those physicians to have now finally, as one told me, has sort of to finally have, you know, kind of discussions with patients about an actual treatment for their disease. And there has been controversy, as we've talked about in the past, because, you know, MASH sort of overlaps with obesity to some extent, and patients who have the very, very early stages of fatty liver disease, which leads to MASH, you know, can be and are being treated with the GLP-1 class of obesity weight loss drugs. So, you know, there's been a kind of a debate of sort of how large of a market there might be commercially for a MASH drug. What Madrigal has told me and what physicians also confirm is that, you know, as MASH progresses and particularly the scarring of the liver, the fibrosis in the liver advances, that that weight loss drugs on their own are not really helpful for patients. And so they need something that's more directed specifically to the liver that reduces the fibrosis, because that's kind of that's the thing that really gets patients. That's what leads to cirrhosis and eventually maybe cancer or the need for a liver transplant. So, I think that will be one of these drugs where we talk about, you know, kind of a show me story. And I think sort of Madrigal is in that we'll have to watch the launch of this drug. The CEO of Madrigal is a guy by the name of Bill Siebold. He joined Madrigal back in September, and he's notable for working at Sanofi for many years, where he was in charge of their specialty drugs, including Dupixent, you know, which is a mega blockbuster that Sanofi partners with Regeneron on. And so he was in charge of that drug launch. He actually brought over as his new chief commercial officer a woman who also was instrumental in launching drugs like Dupixent. So there, I think there's a feeling that if anybody can kind of carve out a new successful launch in a disease where there was no treatment before, it's someone like a Bill Siebold. And so, but we'll, you know, again, I think it will be sort of a show me story to see, you know, as the sort of early numbers of the launch roll in over the next few months.
Late last week, Amylyx Pharmaceuticals delivered the crushing news that its treatment for ALS proved no better than placebo in a pivotal clinical trial, marking the latest setback in the search for medicines that might slow the progression of the fatal disease.
But unlike past disappointments in ALS drug development, Amylyx's treatment, called Relyvrio, is already FDA-approved and being taken by thousands of patients. Relyvrio's failure prompts difficult questions for the company, the FDA, and the entire ALS community.
Joining us to discuss the Amylyx situation is Holly Fernandez-Lynch, a lawyer and bioethicist at the University of Pennsylvania, whose scholarly work has focused on difficult situations, much like this one. Holly, welcome back to the podcast.
Thanks for having me.
So back in 2022, before Relyvrio was approved, Amylyx promised that it would actually voluntarily remove the drug from the market if it proved not to work. So after the phase 3 failure last week, the company said that it would spend the next 2 months reviewing the data, talking to regulators, and eventually deciding whether to do just that. Is withdrawing the drug the right course of action?
Well, so it's a loaded question, right? I mean, we haven't seen the full data. We've seen the top line results. And it's important to keep in mind the conversation that happened at that advisory committee meeting before Relyvrio got FDA approval. So the back and forth between FDA's Billy Dunn and the Amylyx CEO was trying to get them to make a voluntary promise to withdraw. And what the CEO said was not, you know, I hereby solemnly swear that if the phase 3 results don't meet their endpoints, then I will, you know, we'll take the drug off the market. What they said was, we will do what's right for patients. And I gave them a hard time for that, you know, back when they made that statement, right? It's kind of a fuzzy, it's not quite a promise, right? It's not clear exactly what they had in mind from that. I was relieved in their public statements following the phase 3 data readout to say, you know, we're looking at this closely, but there didn't seem to be spin, right? One of the things that you would worry about in a circumstance like this would be, oh, we didn't hit our primary, we didn't hit our secondaries, but we did some post-hoc analyses and it looks like maybe there's positive data in a subgroup. And so we are adamant about keeping it on the market or doing some additional studies. I didn't see anything like that. So it strikes me as very likely that they will in fact withdraw it. That would be the right thing to do here. I'm not suggesting that there should be no further study of the drug, but the idea of allowing Relyvrio on the market was similar to what we see with the accelerated approval pathway, right? It was a compromise. They got full approval. But the idea was, we're going to let you on the market with some uncertainty. If it doesn't pan out, then you have to withdraw. That would be the right thing for patients. And so I'm hopeful that will be the result of these analyses, but we are working without full information here.
So understanding this is hypothetical, but if it were to come to pass that Amylyx were to decide that the right thing for patients was not to remove it from the market for whatever reason and with whatever action in lieu of that, does the FDA have the power on its own to rescind that 2022 approval? And what does like recent history tell us about what that might look like if they were to go down that path?
They do have, you know, FDA does have the authority to withdraw a drug's approval. It's not exclusive to the accelerated approval pathway that FDA can do that. And Billy Dunn from FDA talked about that during that Relyvrio advisory committee meeting. And he gave a long speech about regulatory flexibility, and he emphasized FDA has the authority to pull approvals after a drug is on the market if the statutory standard is no longer met, right, based on additional data that become available. It's a little bit easier, but not easy in the accelerated approval context, because there are some different statutory provisions for an expedited withdrawal process. We know that that process is not truly expedited the way we typically think of the word expedited, but there are pathway, you know, there is a pathway for FDA to withdraw a product that got traditional approval. You know, you asked about recent history. This is just, it's just not a common thing. And when FDA has moved to withdraw a product outside of the accelerated approval context, it's not typically been due to lack of efficacy, but rather due to safety concerns. So if Amylyx were to push back on this, it would be a big pain for FDA. It would not be an easy process, but they do have the legal authority to do it.
So, Holly, Relyvrio's initial approval was not uncontroversial at the time. A panel of FDA advisors initially voted against approving the drug before narrowly recommending it in sort of like a do-over FDA meeting. What does that decision look like in light of this drug's eventual negative outcome that we saw from the study last week?
I've been thinking about this a lot over the past several days, trying to decide in my own mind, do I think this is a success or a failure? The study was a failure in the sense that it didn't demonstrate that the drug was beneficial. A failed study, right, doesn't mean we didn't learn anything from it, right? So it's still important to kind of understand that this is a scientific step forward in the context of figuring out what does and doesn't work for this terrible disease. The other question, though, in my mind is this a successful example of regulatory flexibility, or is this a cautionary tale? Where I am leaning is that this could be an example of a success story, but it all depends on what Amylyx does now. At the time, I mean, as you mentioned, this was unusual from the start, right? First, the company said to FDA, we'd like to apply for approval on the basis of our positive phase 2 data. FDA said, no, you need to do a phase 3. The company started their phase 3. Canada granted approval. You know, the patient advocacy community was pushing for FDA to consider the application. FDA changed course and said, okay, fine, right? Submit your application on the basis of those phase 2 data. The first advisory committee wasn't convinced. Then, right, you have the unusual step of having a second advisory committee. We have this, as I mentioned, kind of this speech from Billy Dunn about regulatory flexibility and the drug is allowed on the market. At the time, I was very torn, right? Should FDA have allowed the drug on the market? It's a terrible disease. They had good phase 2 data. The results of their phase 2 study were not knock your socks off, right? And that is supposed to be the standard, you know, that FDA guidance is calling for to allow a drug on the market based on one positive study. You know, this in phase 2, it seemed to slow the clinical progression of ALS to a statistically significant degree. If you could allow patients to access that drug a bit early and the phase 3 results had been positive, right, we would have all been saying, okay, that was the right gamble. Look, right, this was a great thing for patients. The fact that the phase three was already underway by the time that approval was granted, and the fact that we knew the phase three data were going to be forthcoming because the EU, or you know, the European Medicines Agency was requiring that study in order to consider the application there. We knew it was going to happen pretty quickly that we'd figure out one way or another. So if Amylyx pulls the approval quickly, I think this is an example of successful regulatory flexibility. It didn't pan out for patients, but it was a pretty short window of time that the drug was allowed on the market. We have the conversation often about this balance in the context of accelerated approval. We know there are going to be some duds, right? If you allow a product on the market with some uncertainty, they're not all going to pan out. I think this was a reasonable gamble. But if it turns out that Amylyx pushes back on withdrawal, then I'll say, no, this was a failure of regulatory flexibility. So the jury's still out, but I'm leaning in favor of, like, this was a reasonable thing to try, and it might be a good example of how regulatory flexibility can work.
Talking about that flexibility, you know, the Amylyx approval showed in part the influence of patient groups. It also showed in part the influence of other countries' drug agencies. How do you think that those outside influences from the EU, from Canada, influence this drug decision process?
Yeah, it's just another kind of example of what was unique in the RelieveRio context. I mean, the first thing I'll say is that Americans never want to be second, right? So it's not at all surprising that the American patient advocacy community would say, come on, right? The Canadians have it. If their regulator is convinced, why aren't you convinced, FDA, right? We shouldn't have to go to another country to access a drug that might, you know, that might be beneficial for us. And I had mentioned, right, the EMA was more conservative. The Europeans were more conservative. They didn't want to approve this drug. They did not, in fact, approve it. And of course, it's very unlikely that they would change their mind given these results. But that created a scenario in which FDA could free ride a little bit, because we haven't talked about this explicitly. RelieveRio wasn't eligible for accelerated approval at FDA because they demonstrated benefit on a clinical endpoint, right? They demonstrated a slowing of decline on the ALS functional rating scale. They also had some data about impact on biomarkers, but those data were negative. So the accelerated approval pathway wasn't an option here. That would have been nice, because then FDA could have said, all right, here's the pathway, and we're going to impose a post-market required study. By law, you're going to have to get this phase three done. And so when I said they were able to free ride on the Europeans, they knew, right, that the EU was requiring that phase three study. And so even though FDA didn't require it by law, there was some special circumstances here that allowed us to be pretty confident those data were going to be forthcoming. And I think those influences likely played a role in FDA's decision here and how the advisory committee was thinking about things at their second meeting. I've argued with some collaborators of mine that FDA ought to impose post-market study requirements whenever they grant approval of a drug with some uncertainty about the data, that they shouldn't be doing that exclusively under the accelerated approval pathway. And we've gotten into the legal weeds in the paper that we published to show that FDA could do that without waiting for Congress to change their statutory authority. The more uncertainty there is on the back end, or excuse me, the more uncertainty there is on the front end when you allow a product on the market, the stronger the post-market obligations ought to be. That's part of the compromise.
So something outside of the FDA's control, but definitely germane to this whole process and the sort of broader societal implications of this is drugs aren't free, famously. And so in Amylyx's case, they chose to set a list price of $158,000 for RelieveRio upon its approval. And in the, I guess, 9 months that it was on the market, made hundreds of millions of dollars in revenue from this medicine that we now understand probably has no real benefit for patients taking it. I don't know. How do you square that? Again, it's not, the FDA doesn't regulate drug pricing, but like when you zoom out and look at this as a grand experiment, that expenditure, that societal expenditure that comes out of the system, how do we fit that into this framework?
Yeah, I'm so glad you mentioned that because it's relevant to deciding whether this is a successful example of regulatory flexibility or not. So I was focused before on, you know, FDA's decision, but Amylyx, I think, really inexcusably priced this drug at $158,000 a year before it had confirmed benefit. Now, I recognize that there are R&D costs and they, you know, are trying to recoup their investment. And there has been some discussion in the past several days about taking those sales revenues and investing them in continuing to study this product in other disease areas. I understand all of that. However, it's such a common sense thing to say the amount of money that you expect people to pay for your drug should be aligned with how much evidence you have that that drug is actually going to be beneficial. I'm not suggesting, right, that all of the accelerated approval drugs that are on the market now should double in price or something the minute they get traditional approval. But I do think there ought to be some discounting of the price before a drug has confirmed benefit. And that was one of the challenges. You know, I think most insurers ended up covering Relyvrio. Although I know that there had been some reporting of ALS clinicians saying it was kind of a pain. I would have to get on the phone with the insurer. You know, there was some pushback. I don't know that that's unreasonable pushback, right? To say, look, this drug really hasn't proven that it's beneficial. Why should we be paying hundreds of thousands of dollars? And that's a broader kind of resource allocation challenge, right? How much money should be devoted to these investigational interventions versus other things that could be helpful to the patient community?
Holly, you know, in my reporting on the story, our reporting on the story, you know, when we talk to people who feel like the system did work here, like, you know, they felt like that this is an example of how the process should go. You know, one argument that they make is that no patients were harmed in this entire process. And I wonder, do you feel that way? I mean, is this just like no harm, no foul? Or are there costs, other kinds of costs that patients have to bear when a drug that they were taking is later found out to be ineffective?
OK, let me put it this way. It could have been a lot worse, right? I mean, imagine that the phase 3 data came out and showed that not only was the drug not helping people, but actually there were, you know, worse survival outcomes on the intervention group. So thankfully, it doesn't seem like that was true, but I would not therefore make the leap to say no harm, no foul, right? I mean, we were just talking about the financial harms. Those are, you know, funds that could have been allocated in other ways. And then, you know, there's been a lot of discussion, even in the press release and thereafter, about the drug being well tolerated. And we're all used to kind of seeing these typical side effects, like when we see the drug ads on TV or in magazines, and it's things like, you know, nausea, tiredness, diarrhea, you know, but like those things are unpleasant, right? And they're especially unpleasant if you have, you know, a disease that puts you in a wheelchair, impacts your mobility and things like that. So I, of course, right, you'd be willing to tolerate those side effects for a drug that was really beneficial. But for a drug that's not helping you, those are substantial considerations. And, you know, there's also opportunity costs, right? And I don't have any empirical data about this, but one of the questions that people living with ALS needed to ask themselves was, should I be willing to try Relyvrio? Or, should I pursue other investigational options? Could I participate in a clinical trial, right? There are other ways to spend time, money, effort. And, you know, they had to make those judgments. So I don't think that there was nothing lost here. Nonetheless, right, it might have been a reasonable gamble for FDA to have approved it, an even more reasonable gamble if the drug had been priced more appropriately.
Well, Holly, thank you for joining us to parse through all of the nuances of this situation. We really appreciate it.
Thanks again. And my heart really goes out to the ALS community. They need a win.
I think we all agree.
That does it for another episode of the Read Out Loud.
Thank you to Teresa Gaffney for producing this week's episode.
Our senior producers are Hyacinth Empanado and Alyssa Ambrose. Our executive producer is Pi King Rick Burke, and our theme music is by Brian Joel.
We'd love to hear from you. Tell us what you like about this week's episode, what you didn't like, and whether you liked my key lime pie. You can do that all by sending us an email at readoutloud@statnews.com.
And if you like what we do, leave a review or rating on Apple Podcasts or whichever platform you use to get your podcasts.
See you next week.
When we'll tell you the winner of the pie contest.